notice anything different, ladies and gentlemen?
Yeah, bad lighting. Bad lighting.
This yes, is, that's it. That's exactly what it is. It's bad lighting.
It's bad lighting.
It's
and an apparent backdrop.
I like the exposed brick. How about you?
Well,
I insisted on the exposed brick.
It still has the creases in it from being folded. It's kind of sad.
It'll stretch itself.
So bricks
don't fold.
We are in our first, we're doing our first live stream from what is our new studio.
Look how sharp that camera image is.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
So it's still a work in progress. We are having lighting and stuff that's going to be done much better. But so this is our maiden run. And we have new mics. So you guys will have to let us know what you think. It's work in progress, people, but now do not have to deal with dogs scratching at the door.
No, that's true. But are we going to have any dog?
Well, we can. And when I get some more nests, I call my dog's beds nests. When I get some more nests, then I will be able to have a nest in here. And
we are live.
We are live.
So unfortunately, we were just disrupted. We're going to have people walking in and out of the studio all the time.
No, it's a fingerprint entry and only three people have it. So we'll have a talking to the other two people.
Looks like it's going to be down to one before this is all said and done. So welcome to Generational Change, our slowly dwindling crowd on this Sunday afternoon. Big football game today. I wish the Giants game was more relevant. I would be at Miami right now, but they're 4-7, and that's just not a good year. But yeah, I've been to a couple of games already this season, so I didn't feel overly compelled to go and see the Giants at Hard Rock Stadium. Excuse me. But the Dolphins still have a chance to make the playoffs.
Do you know what I call it? Do you know what I call that stadium?
I don't know. Joe Robbie?
Yes.
Joe Robbie.
I call it Joe Robbie Stadium. So, and I know that that's an age thing for sure. It definitely ages me, but I appreciate it because at the time that was like the first privately built stadium and they didn't need taxpayer dollars to do it. These were business people. They handled their own overhead. And so I respect that.
Yeah. And I also think that, you know, when we had Harvey Kay on our podcast and he is an owner of the Green Bay Packers, wouldn't it be wonderful if all sports teams had that type of option?
It would, but I would at least, my issue is more when you have a business, why is the public that you make private money profits off of, why is the public responsible for helping contribute to your overhead? Well, like, that's the thing. You're a business. And you want to be a business. You don't want to be a public service. If you want to be a public service, then you should be giving free tickets. You're not a public service. You're a business. So why are we paying for your corporate headquarters?
Well, I think the reason we're paying for them is, again, this is something that's been going on for decades. And I remember when, as a Nets fan, a New Jersey Nets fan, the owner, Bruce Ratner, was trying to get every little nook and cranny into his financial coffers for his new arena that he wanted to build. And of course, it wasn't going to be at the Meadowlands, and he ended up moving the team to Brooklyn. Be damned to the fans that were local. It's like, hey, it's about what I want, what I need.
It's a business. So if it's a business, then pay for yourself. Why are we subsidizing?
And that, of course, is the problem with sports today and why I think so many people have been turned off by it, because it's become too commodified. It's too business oriented. You know, baseball used to have, especially like in the World Series, you'd have 25, 30 million people watching it. Today, what do you have? Like a third of that amount watching it, if you're lucky? And that's, again, I think that in part is a reflection of just how corporatized our sports have become in the United States.
Well, and there's so many more options of what to watch.
Look, I am
at the same time, like simultaneously. That's the thing.
I don't know if I agree with that, because it all depends on the season and sports usually don't run up against each other like they used to. But and a good example would be LeBron James. You know, he's still the face of the NBA, but this is a guy who is extremely hyper political, and he also refuses to say anything negative whatsoever about the business practices in China where the products that he sells are made. And so I think a lot of people look at that and say, you really are being a hypocrite about this, because we know you're selling your products at a very high price point, yet the products are being made at an abysmally low price point. So we know that the system isn't fair and you're exploiting people as a result of that. So I do think that that in itself turns off a lot of people when it comes to sports.
Oh, I think there's a lot of things that's turned off people when it comes to sports.
There's also this diva element. When you're making that much money,
for playing a game.
For playing a game. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be paid well, but they're just athletes making $30 million a year.
It's crazy.
I mean, wow.
Now, what I do think is that they should get proper medical coverage and proper insurance and proper stuff and not have to fight about what's covered and what isn't covered when they're retired. Like, I do think that you can pay people well and you can also, you know, pay for them when their job basically beats them brain dead. And I have no problem with that either, even though I do think it's a grown person making a conscious choice to go into a thing where you're just getting beaten up every day in the head.
Well,
it is a Darwinism thing to me to some extent.
So just came across the wire, former senator and former presidential candidate Bob Dole has passed away at the age of 98.
I thought he died already a long time ago.
No, apparently he just passed.
Really?
Yeah,
I don't know. If you had asked me Bob Dole dead or alive, I would have said dead. Like, if we played the dead or alive game, I would have said dead. I really thought he was already dead. All right, well.
Well, I can't say that I feel too bad. I beat him once, and now I beat him.
You know what? You know what? From seeing how we've come in terms of what is considered a Republican or what is considered the right, Bob Dole, not quite as offensive as one would have thought.
No, I don't even think he was offensive.
Well, he was just very uptight and square and whatever. I got to tell
John, you're so cruel, brother. So cruel.
Well, honestly, if we were playing the dead or alive game, I would have thought if somebody said Bob Dole, I would have said dead. I honestly would have thought he was already dead.
Well, we're going to have a lot of fun things to talk about today with our guests that we have both been looking forward to having on the show. You know him from Rising and I believe Breaking Points as well. He's the editor-in-chief of The Real, Real News Network.
The Real News Network, which is one of my sources. I have a few different ones that I, subscribe to, but I do.
Well, we're buttering her up nicely. Max Alvarez, welcome to Generational Change.
Hey, y'all. Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here. Yeah.
Absolutely. We like to rotate through actual journalists and people with information from time to time and expose people to what that's like, especially if what they're used to is mainstream media. Because it's brain damage. It's very toxic. The truth is, I don't watch it and I haven't in years. And the only reason I even know what goes on there is from when somebody in the alternate universe mentions it.
Yeah, it can feel a bit like you're living through Clockwork Orange, right? You gotta like put your eyes up and force yourself to watch what's going on mainstream news, because you know as much as we all in independent media want to get people over to our outlets and get them better information, better insight, better guests. Cover topics that mainstream media won't. The fact of the matter is that most people still get their news from mainstream outlets. And yep. We're having this conversation at the very moment that, you know, a major scandal happened at one of the biggest outlets with Chris Cuomo protecting his brother, you know, and now getting fired. So good on CNN, but also the response from other people in the mainstream, like, sphere has really just put on display like how this sort of in-group of elite media kind of professionals really do have an outsized influence on our national political consciousness, what we see, what we don't see, what voices we hear. And that's a really important battlefront to be fighting on, because we can't just cede that territory to these people.
You know, I just wanted to say, it's funny that everyone is sitting here and talking about Chris Cuomo, this thing about him being, what is he called? It's not fired. He's, suspended?
They fired him.
Oh,
they fired him last night.
They just announced that they were, in fact, firing him.
Oh, okay. See, this is me not watching. Okay, so here's the thing. Why are we not talking about how he even got that job in the first place and the kind of people that are chosen for those positions based on their connections and based on who they know? That's why he even had that job. See, he wouldn't have had that job if he weren't Cuomo. So the mere existence of him in that job is a conflict because he's already who he, like, it's all connected. That's what I think is so interesting. Like, it isn't that he protected his brother. Well, yeah, he did. It's, he was put there to basically protect all the powerful people that be. And that is why people like him have those jobs.
And it's almost like ESP, because that's exactly where I was going to lead into, was with Cuomo and the fact that he was fired. How much worse do you think it was going to get? Because the only reason, in my humble opinion, I'm sure you would all agree, that he got canned, officially canned, because you saw what Crystal and Sagar and them were saying the other day, how this is just going to be temporary. They'll bring him back in maybe a few months. I'm guessing that whatever additional info was going to come out was going to be really, really ugly. What do you think about that?
I would agree. I mean, I tried to hesitate as much as possible to kind of make claims that I haven't been able to fully research, but that is my suspicion as well, is just given the nature of what we know about CNN and network news operations and how they work, like you're saying, Jay, the sort of protective, sort of class-based nature of the mainstream media sphere, it was very, apparent to, I think, all of us that, this machine was going to try to protect someone like Cuomo if it could at all costs. I mean, we and it's not just, news media that we've seen this in, right? I mean, it took a massive amount of women being brave enough to speak publicly and supporting one another for the tyrannical reign of someone like Harvey Weinstein to finally come crumbling down. So my suspicion is, as you suggested, that there must have been some kind of pile of evidence that they were sitting on, that they were like, okay, if this goes public and we, we're not going to have a leg to stand on here. So I do highly suspect that this was not, CNN acting morally. This was not them, doing the right thing.
And all about the bottom line.
It must have been something in that regard.
Not that they really have, not in the way that it's going at this point. In a lot of ways, it's like corporate media is very much like the current incarnation of the GOP and even the Democrats to a lesser extent. It's this idea that, the writing's on the wall. You have to change. People are evolving. They want you to do that. And rather than evolve, their attitude is, we'll just suppress the hell out of you. That's easier. So as we see on our channel is horrifically suppressed. We do everything we can from a grassroots perspective to share it. I'm sure you deal with that a lot. That's one of the things that we've obviously talked about on, when it comes to independent media, is this idea that we really have to be a lot more cohesive. Certain channels like Jordan Chariton of Status Quo, for example, a couple others that I've mentioned before, we really do our best to try to uplift those voices because, the algorithm is destroying us. Mm-hmm. Like that corporate media's attitude is, well, if you're not going to watch us, we're going to make sure that nobody's watching your asses either.
But that's, and the other reason that I like to lift up those people is that I want to live amongst educated populace. And right now I live amongst ignoramus. And so what I can do to further propagate accurate information, and that's we're better off with people being informed.
I agree. And I have actually a kind of point about that because, I think this goes to the heart of the mission of The Real News and one of the reasons that I'm so honored to work there. But I guess before I get there, to really piggyback on what y'all were just saying, I deeply appreciate your efforts to kind of lift up voices in independent media that are doing the work to cover worker issues, to cover important political issues, and to bring on critical voices and expose, the public to those voices in a way that mainstream media won't. And, I think that one of the things that I think I've known since I wrote my first article, for The Baffler years ago, right, is that not just in the left or progressive media sphere, but in the kind of digital media ecology that we're all living in and trying to survive in, the incentive structure of that media ecosystem pushes us in directions that are directly at odds with building political coalitions, with fusing, like bonds between people through solidarity, right? We're actively fighting against those incentive structures that actually try to train us to feel like we're all competing with one another, right? And that if, you know, if Jordan gets views on his great coverage of you know, like the Starbucks unionization effort, that means that we're not getting those and we should be pissed off about that. No, the point is that we are all up against this massive, tightly controlled corporate media system. And, you know, we are all fighting, you know, again, as you just said, to attain visibility in this sort of, you know, carnivalesque funhouse that Silicon Valley has created for us, where they can effectively, with any tweaks to their black boxed algorithms that none of us know what those tweaks are, how those algorithms really work. That's all proprietary stuff that's kept in secret. And yet our very livelihoods and our very ability to stay informed about our world are controlled by these giant corporations that have a very vested interest in suppressing the kind of work that we do in independent and progressive media. So with all of that working against us, I think it is incredibly important to do what y'all are doing, to do what we try to do at The Real News, which is collaborate, right? To again, do what you can to work against that incentive structure that teaches you to see other folks doing great work as competitors in a zero-sum game for clout, views, and subscriptions. We have to be working harder to lift one another up, to bring our audiences in conversation with one another, and to sort of build through that kind of, you know, patchwork process, a public that has a shared notion of truth, that has at least some sort of common ground to have political dialogue on. That's what we're seeing with the kind of algorithmic echo chambers that are created, with the sort of like, you know, fanships, fandoms that develop around certain network cable shows or certain YouTube shows. You end up kind of having these sorts of, you know, tribes of information that we're not even really, the farther we go in that direction, the less we're even having the same conversation. This is something that I realize when I do talk to, you know, conservatives who only watch certain types of media or who want me to respond to certain issues. I find it very hard to actually address the things they want me to, because if I'm not actively watching what they're watching and I'm just kind of doing my own research, there will be so many points that like are very important to them that I'm like, I don't even know why that's important, or like why I didn't know that that was a major thing on your radar. So that's one of the reasons, again, going back to where we started, that I do try to kind of at least know what is going on in these other sort of pockets. But yeah. I think that as a strategy, as a political strategy, as a political necessity, all of us involved in independent media need to be actively working against that fragmentation of a public that increasingly is becoming unrecognizable to itself.
And the one thing we've definitely noticed, we don't know how the algorithm works, but we know one part of how it works, and that is it feeds off of drama. So if we turned our show into just basically a show that just criticizes other YouTube, you know, content creators, we would probably do pretty well, because a number of other shows have done that. They basically just spend time. You remember,
they exist just to comment on other content creators.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't believe how long they were able to stretch the whole Cenk versus Jimmy thing. And it's like every day, and this, they said this thing, and that tweet said that thing. And again, you get a lot of views, and some have actually built channels off of it. I mean, it's amazing. But at the same time, it's not surprising, because at the end of the day, the non-corporate side of things, which is what we're involved with, if we're fighting amongst ourselves, that means, you know, corporate power is maintaining itself. Well, so that's going to feed it.
That's the thing. We don't understand the algorithm, but we know who it serves. So it's very obvious that it's basically the tech world's version of keeping us all fighting amongst ourselves. And I laugh at it because it's so ridiculous to me that, like, I really do. I feel like it's when I was a kid, I would have said, you people need to get a life. you really need to get a life. Like, there's really important stuff going on, and that isn't getting covered. And you're just being a distraction. You're just adding to the distraction. There's really important things that are happening. Like what you said, when somebody asks you about something, you're like, I don't know what you're talking about, because it's some obscure talking point that they heard on whatever show they're watching. And yet you're interested in what actually is happening. And so those are very different things. And I'm often out of the loop when it comes to what's going on in mainstream culture.
And you also mentioned, you know, what is the other side? What are the more libertarian independents and even conservatives thinking? You know, Jen went on Tim Pool's show and it got a lot of views. It was like 600,000 people.
What percentage of them called me Karen?
Maybe a third, but you know. But that's somebody that we, you know, would consider a friend, and you know, we don't agree with a lot of what he says, but at the end of the day, you have to know, like, his audience is big and you have to know what they're thinking as well. Like, what are they prioritizing? And I think that in itself is also something, you know, when I hear people say, well, you can't go on Fox News or whatever.
How you build alliances. Yeah, that's how you find commonality.
You don't have to go on there and say, yeah, I agree that all immigrants should go back to wherever they came from. How about, listen, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I believe. And maybe we could find common ground. And so
Their people. Yeah. That's the other thing. It gets our message to a whole different audience that would otherwise not have our message.
I agree.
And as long as our message is still on point, that's the only thing that matters. It just exposes it to new people that can just be angry and call you Karen, which is fine.
Well, I'm glad that we ended up there, because I think that's like really the point to underline, right? Because, you know, even after stressing, as I just did, right, the importance of collaboration, I think that, you know, it's also really important that we don't fall into that same sort of trap of having an insider's club that corporate media has developed over decades, right? And so what I mean by that is, you know, one of the things that does depress and infuriate me, not only as a media professional myself, but as a brown person in a very white dominated media sphere who constantly has to kind of hustle to get people to take me and my voice and the people that I cover seriously. What I have learned through hard experience, as many others have learned and are learning right as we speak, right, is that you do have these sorts of in-group dynamics. You do have this sort of high school, mentality whereby different YouTube shows, podcasts, media productions, so on and so forth, the focus starts to become like, can the people in charge of those operations be friends or friendly, right? You know, and I think what I would stress to folks is that, you know, it is absolutely important to find, as you said, that common ground, to know what people on opposing sides are thinking, respond to them, not so that we could all sort of like gel into this gray mush, right? You know, where, you know, we somewhat agree on this or that thing, but so that we can make a strong case for, you know, the principles that we believe in, the politics that we know we need in this country and beyond to get us out of the like truly horrendous situations that we are currently in. And so I guess the sort of point that I'm making is that when we do go on these other shows, when we do reach out to these other audiences, when we do try to kind of know and understand what people who think differently than us are actually thinking, right? Again, the point is not to just kind of be chameleons and adapt ourselves to what these other audiences will like, to the point where our own principles become, you know, unrecognizable. The point is to actually go in there and make that case for the things that we believe in, to stand by our principles, to speak up for working people, to speak up for the oppressed, to hold power to account, to point out that the different solutions people may be coming up with to address things like world historic inequality, climate change, so on and so forth, that we should not be blaming immigrants, that we should not be blaming other sectors of the working class, that we should not be like finding these different scapegoats. We need to keep our eye on the ball because the people who are oppressed us, the people who are screwing us over, the people who are getting off like bandits right now, are very apparent, right? And so we have to keep that our eye on that. Point being, again, as I said, is that I think it's really important, like y'all were just saying, to, you know, find those different audiences, know exactly what they are thinking. But, you know, I see a lot of, you know, self-serving, you know, folks in the media essentially try to kind of you know, endear themselves to different types of audiences because they have a product to sell. They want to build up their subscriber base, their viewer base, but they're not actually serious about kind of conveying a political message that, you know, can actually address the things that we're up against. They're more concerned, like people in mainstream media are, with just making friends and building a career. And so all of us have to be vigilant, right? You know, to kind of go forth as you guys were just talking about, right? Go forth, spread the good word, be attentive listeners, you know what people want to hear us respond to, but really kind of plant our flag in the ground and say, like, look, this is who we are. This is what we stand for. This is why I think you should come over to this side, you know, and I think it's a tough thing to negotiate, especially when, as we just said, we are all hustling in a media ecology where our very livelihoods are dependent upon, you know, these algorithms that we don't control, on subscriber bases that are spread all over the place. So again, the incentive pushes us in different ways, but we've got to kind of, you know, like walk and chew gum at the same time, as I always say.
Definitely sounded like Dave Rubin you were talking about. Just saying. I mean, he's
not to name names.
No, but he's really the poster child for that. I always say, if you're looking at like what the embodiment of what we're trying not to do is, to not be like that.
I wouldn't even know who half those people were. Like, I wouldn't have known who Dave Rubin was until I heard people sort of like mocking him. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known who it was. Like, these are not people that I would know anything about them.
But for a lot of them, it like you said, it becomes this career arc in many ways, and then they get book deals, and that's not why we're doing this.
No.
You know, we're doing this because, and this is a great segue into what I went through last night, because I was saving this. I was actually at the Florida Democratic Party's Blue Gala in Orlando, and so when corporate
media,
yeah,
I was going to say, did you sneak Jen in through the back door?
I was not.
Not when I literally walked in. The only reason I was at the gala was because a good friend of mine who's up in the party
gave me a ticket.
I was not spending $300 to go into that room.
We would not contribute funds to the Democratic Party.
No.
So that, like, let me preface this with, he was gifted a ticket and he was sort of there like doing recon.
So as soon as I walk in the door, like literally we're in there, and my friend looks at me and says, oh, Debbie's over there. I'm going to go say, I was like, Debbie Wasserman Schultz? Like, you could go over there and talk to her. I ain't having any of that. So it was like, it's like to set the tone right away. And the way that the media, you know, corporate media kind of conveys it, especially in the Miami Herald, is this idea that, oh, the Democrats are strategizing 2022.
Yeah, they're strategizing how to lose. I'm just thinking,
your keynote speaker for this event was Jim Clyburn. I don't know, but...
And not in person, by the way.
No, he was there. He actually
I thought
he was Zooming. He actually showed up. And it was amazing to me just how they had... And I couldn't believe how big the room was. I'm thinking, oh, they're going to get a lot of people in there. They probably filled half the room. So there's that, which doesn't get talked about.
Their attendance is so pitiful.
And then they had... You know, they actually had Wasserman Schultz on like doing a pep rally. Like having her go up on stage and be like, oh, we're Democrats. We're going to do this, that, and the other thing. And I'm thinking, if any GOP operatives are in this room right now, they're like, oh, we are literally cruising to the finish line next year. Like,
oh,
this is going to be so easy.
I think it's DeSantis in such a landslide.
And then they had the three gubernatorial candidates come up and speak. In my humble opinion, I think Charlie Crist is going to win the nomination. That's based on my observation.
That's the best they got.
In terms of who is, you know, who is going to connect with the super voters and all that. And Nikki Fried talks and basically sounds like a robot, all due respect. That's what we've more or less evolved into, is this party is really crumbling in a way that I always thought would, after what they did to Bernie in 2016, after what Debbie did on Hillary's behalf in 2016, I always thought was ultimately going to come back and get them. And it looks like it's getting them now, because they really can't get out of their own way. And the fact that they control all three elected branches and they're doing absolutely nothing, and they can throw the, you know, they can do the rotating villain all they want with Manchin and Sinema and Gottheimer and whoever else they want to throw. The reality is, when you are a completely corporate captured party, people are eventually going to wake up to it and say, I don't want this anymore. And I think that that's what's happening. Is that what you're observing?
Yes. I mean, like, you know, when When right now a lot of, you know, diehard Hillary Clinton stans, both within the party and just kind of around the country, are essentially trying to blame the Supreme
Susan Court Sarandon.
Rolling, yeah, basically blame the rights attack on civil rights through the civil court, which has been a decades long project that is coming to fruition right now and that is going to hurt a lot of people. We're hearing that this is basically Susan Sarandon's fault for not, you know, like, you know, just being on the Hillary train in 2016. And the thing that always kind of blows me away when I hear this is I was like, if your sort of political machine can be derailed by Susan Sarandon, then it was never that strong to begin with, right? You know, like, then you don't have a very effective political machine, which they don't. But they don't want to acknowledge that. They don't want us to acknowledge that. They just, you know, there's a really kind of fundamental complex in the liberal centrist Democratic mind, right? Where, you know, if you lose an election, right, you tend to reflect and blame yourself on the missteps that you made. The Democrats don't do that. The Democrats reflect and they think who in the voting public is to blame for us losing, right? That has been the kind of Democratic MO for basically my entire lifetime. The only lesson, quote unquote, that I think I've ever seen the Democrats openly acknowledge and say they're going to learn from and do differently in the future to avoid is going too far left. Right. That, I think, is the only mistake that Democrats have ever been willing to make. And again, that has characterized my entire lifetime. Basically, when the Democrats got their asses kicked in the 70s against Nixon, that was the lesson that they supposedly learned, was like, OK, we can't go too far left. And they have been running on that philosophy for the next half century. But when it comes to everything else, all the other ways that they have managed to alienate voters, to exhaust voters' goodwill, to basically incentivize voters to stay home, all the different ways that they have failed to deliver for working people on a million different fronts, whether that is, you know, helping out families like mine who lost everything during the Great Recession, helping out working people who are, you know, victimized by finance capital and these big banks, instead of just bailing out those banks and allowing them to continue doing the very things that caused the financial meltdown over a decade ago in the first place, instead of actually fighting for workers to have more power in their everyday lives by strengthening, you know, our abilities to unionize, or at least, you know, like loosening the grip that corporations like Amazon have over our labor system. There are so many ways that, you know, Democrats could get more people on their side and could hold themselves up as the party that is actually fighting for regular, everyday working people in this country. Instead, for them, it's all about how do we keep doing the same crap that we've been doing? How do we keep, you know, empowering and enriching our donors? How do we keep the, you know, bipartisan, you know, imperialist war machine doing what it does abroad? How do we keep doing all the same stuff, but effectively message our way out of it and try to kind of basically convince people that we're something that we're not? This is, you know, again, what we hear after every election that the Democrats lose, it's always like, well, what was wrong with our messaging? Why didn't, you know, voters realize that we're the party that's good for them? And I was like, it's not, you're only thinking about this as like a slogan process. Like, politics is just sloganeering for the Democrats. If you actually delivered for working people, that's the best slogan that you could possibly have. You say, is your life better than from before we came into office? Yes. Here you go. That's because we're working for you. It's not about how do we, you know, create a better, you know, a political campaign slogan to make you think that we're something different, to make you think that we may deliver for you when we all know that we're not going to. And then in turn, when we don't, when we fail and we lose in an election, we're going to blame you, the voters, for that loss. So you can only do that so many times before people start saying, I don't want to have anything to do with either of these parties.
Which is what we saw in when Trump won. And yet they didn't learn. And this is what brings me to where in 2016 was an epiphany for me. We're talking about it like they don't know how to win and they don't. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I think it's meant to work exactly how it's working. I don't think they want to do it differently. I think they like to have people like Trump in office. They get to play Mick resistance. They get to fundraise and they get to blame them for everything because they don't want to change anything. So to me, it's just all like WWF. Like I don't even, it's not real. It's just, it's silliness. And they fight over a non-existent budget like your mom and dad would fight at home over money, like there's a household budget. And it's just this, it's political theater and none of it matters. And they're just all sitting there siphoning money. It's basically money laundering is how I viewed the system. It's just, they're just taking our money and siphoning it up to the top.
Mm-hmm. I would agree, right? And like, and this is connected to the media question that we started talking about, right? I think, I think Ken Klippenstein over at the Intercept was just pointing out, he's like, man, you know, for all of the vitriol that you get on mainstream media that pitches like the battle between Democrats and Republicans is like the fate of the country is held in the balance. Tucker Carlson's over there asking, like, you know, Hunter Biden for a letter of recommendation for his kid to get into school. I mean, these people all know each other. They all like each other. They all go to bat for one another. It's all this kind of shadow game. Like, it feels like I'm living in a Philip K. Dick novel, right? Where it's just like, you know, we are all living in one sort of reality. And the kind of forces of control, be they in the media, be they in, the kind of, you know, finance capital on Wall Street, right? Be they, you know, executives of major corporations and the military industrial complex, so on and so forth. They are very much living in a different reality, right? And their task is to use propaganda, is to use this sort of performative battle between them to make it seem like we're in fact all in the same boat, that we're all living in this sort of same reality. When we're not, right? As you said, this is why I think that sort of Democratic tactic that we have seen play out over, you know, like, geez, the past two decades is starting, I think, to run out of steam where, God, the Democrats were just kind of like tweeting out this week, you know, when it's becoming increasingly clear that, you know, Roe v. Wade may no longer, you know, like be Roe v. Wade may be overturned by the Supreme Court and they're not going to stop there. The Democrats' message was vote Democratic to save, you know, abortion rights. And I was like, that's what we did. That's what people did. They've been doing that. And you still haven't safeguarded that right. You still haven't used that political will to guarantee that this sort of thing could not be overturned by political appointees in the future. So you actually do not care about protecting people's rights to necessary things like abortion, like gay marriage, like all these other civil rights that are currently on the chopping block right now. If you did, you would have worked harder to secure them and safeguard them and protect them from what we're seeing right now. You can only, again, do that so much to say, like, vote like your life depends on it. Okay, people did. They've done that multiple times. And you keep, like, not doing what, you know, you keep not acting like our lives are depending on it. Workers are voting like their lives are dependent on it. The people they vote for are not acting in kind. And ultimately, you're going to exhaust people's political faith in you to actually do anything. And all of us are going to hurt because of that. And I just, you know, it really does. I think this is really one of the important tasks for all of us in media, right, is to really highlight for people like that this is indeed happening, that there is, you know, beyond the Gilded Age at this point, like there is such a massive sort of divide in this country. Basically, you know, the United States has managed to create a sort of like concretized caste system while pretending that it is a democracy. And now that like more of us are realizing that, oh crap, you know, the people at the top, they're secured. They have turned, you know, this entire system into something that will enrich and empower them at our collective expense. And now there's basically nothing we can do about it because the barriers to entry on the electoral realm and the economic realm are so high that we're basically screwed unless we build a sort of mass working class movement to counteract it. That's really where we're at right now.
That's what I said. I just wanted to answer Ryan's question because Ryan had a question about how we can get more working people in Congress. And I would say there's a couple of things to talk about there. One, you would need an actual labor party. Okay. We need a labor party. Right now we have no labor party. So you would want a labor party and then have people that are in that party that are working people. Like that's to me how it would work. And then the key thing is you have to elect non-corporate people. You have got to start electing people that do not take corporate money. And only when there's enough of those people in there can the laws change to allow more working people to come in. The way to do that is, I don't know. Did you do third party? Do you try to take over the Democratic Party? We're all just sort of milling through it. But the end result is we need to have labor representation and we do not have any.
And I think that there's going to be a huge opening in 24. I thought it was going to take until 28, but it looks like right now it's pretty clear based on the way things are moving. If you're being objective, it looks like Biden is not going to run again. And obviously I don't think he'd be capable of doing it anyway. So they are pushing Mayor Pete, and he will always be Mayor Pete, to the front of the line. And they're showing their hand. Now, I don't believe Bernie's going to run again. I think it's pretty safe to say that that's not going to happen. But I do think that the lane is wide open for a non-corporate progressive to not only run and really cultivate Bernie's movement, but ultimately decide that they're going to take the next step. They're going to be like, maybe even like Trump, in the sense that, you know, we're not messing around this time. You know, if you screw with us, you know, maybe it's going to have to be taking this movement into another party. You know, I think what Andrew is doing, Andrew Yang with the Forward Party, is a really novel idea. So long as he stays away from the corporate special interest money. He was on our podcast. He said that he would. Obviously, we got to hold him to that. But I think that there is sort of like this, the dam is going to break type situation where we're not going to, you fooled us once, the pandemic happened, Lord knows it was twice. But I do think that we're getting to the point now where something's going to give, like something's really going to give. And, you know, depending on how bad things go next year with the midterms, and they're going to go bad, then this is going to be.
Well, it depends on what your perspective is on good or bad.
Well, again, it's going to be a bloodbath in favor of the GOP.
Oh,
like it's just so obvious that that's what's happening. And if that is the case, what do you see happening in terms of the cultivating of the progressive movement? Like, are we growing up now? Because this has been sort of like this 5-year odyssey from the start of the whole Bernie Trump phenomenon. And, you know, a lot of people who were never in politics before, they really don't know what to expect. They thought that this would be a just, you know, opportunity. Many people are walking away because they can't stand the corruption. But at some point, it's like, no, you know what? We're hardened now. We know how the game is played. We've learned a lot. Now we're really going to take over. How do you see sort of the evolution over the next couple of years?
You know, it's an interesting question, because I mean, I guess first I would say that, you know, the past decade has taught me to be much more humble when it comes to making political predictions, right? Yeah. None of us thought Donald Trump was going to be president. None of us knew that a pandemic was going to turn our world upside down. Right. There's a lot that has, you know, in the past few years that has taught me to kind of maybe pump the brakes before I confidently claim what's going to happen. That being said, it sure as hell looks like the Democrats are, you know, lining up for a butt kicking in 2022 and 2024 for the reasons that we've already laid out here, but also for reasons that we haven't even touched on yet. You know, at The Real News, one of our great reporters, Jessel Knorr, is doing kind of an extended grant-funded investigation into the battle for voting rights in 6 different states. And what we're seeing in different states is, like, you know, just like happened every time Republicans lose an election, they immediately go to the legislature and say, okay, we got to roll back voting rights. They do it every time, and they're successful at it. And, you know, maps in Georgia and Wisconsin, North Carolina, I mean, like, The gerrymandering has been off the charts. Democrats have basically done nothing to really counteract it at a legislative level. Biden, I think, was the one who said, like, oh, we're going to out-organize it. And Jessel Knorr is, like, one of the people on the ground interviewing the organizers who are now, like, bearing the brunt of all of this burden to out-organize coordinated GOP voter suppression. And they're like, look, we're doing everything we can. If the Democrats want us to out-organize, they need to invest more in what we're doing. They also need to give us something to sell. Because when we go to people, we say, you got to get out here and vote like your life depends on it. They'll be saying, it's like, well, that's what we did the last election. And my life hasn't gotten any better. Right. You guys have done the same crap. Right. So this is what I mean by, you know, Democrats are really showing their hand, as y'all said, that you know, they really don't take seriously, you know, the ways that working people view them. They only see the problem as people are too stupid to realize that we're what's best for them. We're not going to change. The thing is, their mentality needs to change. The most that we're going to do to kind of meet them in the middle is come up with a better slogan to sort of draw them in. That's only going to work so many times before people eventually say, you know what, screw it, I'm done with this. And that kind of leads me into my answer to the second question, right? You know, one of the things that I try to stress on my podcast, Working People, where I've been interviewing workers and organizers for a number of years now, the work that we do at The Real News to cover not just labor issues, but the violence and victims of American policing, the prison industrial complex, the imperialist war machine, yada, 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 right? We try to really cover and lift up the struggles of everyday people around the globe who are fighting against these massive hegemonic and awful forces that are screwing all of us over. What I tried to kind of like stress to people is everything that we're talking about here is important, right? It's important in the sphere of electoral politics. The questions that we're asking are vital for figuring out in this one realm of politics, what the hell do we do? The planet is like, you know, we are killing the planet. We are going to upend human civilization as we know it within the span of a couple decades. And none of the people who have the most power to do anything about it are going to. It is quite literally a death cult where the fossil fuel industries and the politicians who serve them are basically committed to draining, you know, as much profit as they can out of this energy system until, you know, like it's no longer profitable. Then they're going to start introducing more green technologies to profit off of that. All the while, the planet is going to hell and we are all going to live in quite a hellish dystopia, right? So we know that the electoral system is a big damn problem because neither party is actually doing anything to address the issues that are, you know, impacting all of our lives. What I try to stress to people is that there are also other realms of politics at play here, right? So a lot of the workers that I talk to, when we breach the topic of electoral politics, I would say that I don't want to misrepresent what folks tell me, where it's not necessarily as zeroed in and focused on the ins and outs of DC or state legislatures that are driving them away from electoral politics. For most people, we are worked too hard and we are living too close to the bone and we are dealing with too much other crap in our lives because our landlord is trying to hike our rents, because our boss is on our back, because our work schedules are changing every week and I got to scramble to find childcare because this country doesn't provide it, because I got to figure out how to pay my dying husband's healthcare bills because we don't have Medicare for all. These are the kind of issues that people are dealing with on a day-to-day level. These are the kinds of things that we need to focus on because we have to. It's like the stuff that's in our lives. And this is usually what people will tell me is like, you know, I don't have time for what's going on in DC. I'm worried about my kids. I'm worried about keeping a roof over my head, right? I'm worried about my student loans, right? And how the hell I'm going to pay them. So I guess I wanted to just kind of inject that here, that when people are already so kind of exploited and pushed in so many different directions and bullied in so many different ways in their daily lives, they lose patience with politicians, you know, saying, hey, we're going to help you. And then showing, oh, actually, no, no, we're not. We just want, you know, your donations. We just want your votes. And then we're going to drop you like a bad habit, you know, like as soon as you get us into office. What that means is that, you know, so what does that mean for kind of questions about building a labor party, right? Taking, you know, like the political energy that a working class can generate. What do we do with that? I do think that we are perhaps entering a phase of a tipping point of exhaustion where people have seen that, you know, if you can mobilize even just parts of the working class, I'm not going to say that Bernie, you know, got the entire working class behind him, but he got more of the working class than your typical Democratic, you know, presidential candidate does. And he really kind of, you know, was appealing to that broad voter base. The great, I mean, we always talk about Democrat, Republican voters. The biggest voting block is the forgotten block of non-voters who have lost all faith in the political system, the majority of whom are working class people. So Bernie, you know, really made a gamble there to say, like, these are the people I'm going after. And I think that it was very exciting for all of us to finally hear. I've spoken to tons of workers who said that was the first time I've ever felt like a politician saw me and saw what I was going through. And that's what made me actually want to register to vote in the first damn place. So then the question became is you got the people's hopes up. You got people to kind of invest in a dying political system or a dead political system they lost all faith in. And then to see the machinations at the top, to see, you know, Obama, you know, the just become an evil villain, saying, like, making his phone calls, getting all these candidates to drop out so that Biden could win. You see things like what happened to India Walton. She was a working class, you know, like, candidate. She played by the rules. And then, like, when it was becoming apparent that the establishment Democrat was going to lose, they broke the rules. That's what they're always going to do. They want to take progressive energy. They want to take working class energy when it's beneficial for them, but they will never actually relinquish that power unless it is forcibly taken from them. I think that's the lesson that so many people are learning right now. And I guess to end this long rant, that doesn't give an answer to the question of what we can do with a third party, but I do hopefully think it sort of raises the stakes of finding some sort of political solution there, because otherwise you're going to keep exhausting people's political faith and their political will. They're going to give up, and then the ruling class is going to continue to dominate with the voting minority that puts it in power. This is why I also really stress to people. Now I'm getting to my actual point, right? As I stress to people, it's like there are realms of politics that we all need to be invested in. People think that I'm just like a crazy nut job Marxist because I'm always talking about unions and the labor movement and the importance of organizing in your workplace. And that's, you know, that's part of it, right? You know, I'm not gonna lie and say like that's not part of it. But like another reason why I stress that and why I'm always talking to, you know, independents, left wingers, and more conservative workers about this is they realize, they're like, look, I don't care if the guy across from me has a Trump sticker on his truck. We are both on the same shop floor. We're both getting screwed over by our boss, and we need to figure out a way to work together as a group to get what we deserve. That is not what we are encouraged to do in the realm of electoral politics. We are encouraged to be at each other's throats, to segment ourselves, to divide ourselves by race, ethnicity, state, you know, all these different things that ultimately benefit the two parties that, as you said before, are kind of like maintaining the status quo. They're not really at each other's throats. We're the ones who are getting screwed over. And yet, in order to make that system work, you got to keep the working class and even middle class people at each other's throats and build these sort of shadow rivalries that we can compete in. That is a recipe for disaster. That is a recipe for the working class never actually finding an outlet to channel its energies into something robust enough to take on the hegemony of capitalism and so on and so forth. What we need to do is look to and invest in things like the labor movement, things like building bonds of solidarity and mutual support between the labor movement and other social justice movements, like the Poor People's Campaign is doing right now. They're really trying to fuse people, you know, who are fighting for climate change, who are fighting for housing justice, they're trying to fuse their causes together because we have so long to go to get people at the grassroots level to build up those muscles and feel like they actually have some power in their lives to make the change, because the only realm that we're told to channel that energy into is electoral politics, a bankrupt electoral realm that is never going to actually do what we need it to do. Then we get depressed, exhausted, that energy goes into nothing. So we need to be focusing on realms where people can actually feel empowered to imprint themselves and their will on the world that they live in, feel empowered to work together to achieve common goals, so on and so forth.
I think that that is exceptionally well stated. And, you know, from what I always like to point out, and I truly believe this is one of the reasons why Trump became president in 16. It's maybe the most underrated part of the whole argument about, you know, what's the right way to go, what's not. When everybody knew that Bernie was being completely shafted by the party, I saw it everywhere. So when people talk about how was the election rigged, how much time do you have? Because I can rattle off. It could take me a day to go through
from
all
top
of it.
To bottom, like all
just
over.
Just a simple example of when he lost the state of Missouri. They got caught in St. Louis doing electioneering all over the place, all over, handing out illegal pamphlets on behalf of the party, telling people to go vote for Hillary Clinton. That's one example, and that's election rigging. But what I thought was a classic example of what ultimately benefited Trump the most was the fact that the RNC was, obviously, they're not as manipulative as the DNC is, but they themselves were trying to either put Rubio or Kasich at the head of the table and basically say, we're going to push Trump to the side. And Trump came up and he said, if you do this to me, let me tell you, I am totally going to drop out. I'm going to run as an independent and I will totally screw you. And that's what he did. And they all backed off. They all said, well, you know what? I guess he's got us by our ball sacks, so we got to go with what he wants.
You had to say that.
Because that's what ultimately it takes. There's a reason why, even now, we look back at why there were so many ardent defenders of Cuomo. People like politicians with balls. Like, that's just the way it is. And it's the same thing with DeSantis. And Trump was like, I'm going to take him on. And they love that. And Bernie was not willing to go there. He was not willing to say, if you keep not being nice to me, I'm going to tell you right now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave the Democratic Party and then I'm going to run in the Green Party. And that's what I'm going to do. And if he had done that, who knows what would have happened? They were screwing him anyway, but at least have the wherewithal to say, I'm not going to take
this. I'm taking my people and we're hitting the road.
I'm not taking this lying down. And you'd have to think, if Bernie had chosen to go that path, even if he was only threatening to do it, who knows what might have happened? The corporate media would have come down on him like an avalanche. You would have had every normie privileged Dem in the suburbs saying, we didn't want that SOB in our party anyway. He's not a real Democrat.
He's not blah, a blah, real blah. Democrat.
You can run and do whatever you want. It'll be your fault that we lose.
No, it's Jill Stein.
But ultimately, it could have created this whole new movement into a new party. And I think whoever is going to take the reins of the progressive movement, of Bernie's movement, if they were to run as a Democrat in the next election, I think that that's the next element, that the next evolution that needs to happen. This idea of, I'm going to run in your party, but you're going to play nice. And if you don't play nice, I am going to destroy your party. And to me, I think that that's the next evolution. Do you see that as a distinct possibility? And do you agree with the notion that one of the reasons Trump won is because he was willing to go to take that next step that perhaps Bernie should have taken but wasn't willing to take?
So I think that part, you know, definitely makes a lot of sense to me. You know, I mentioned that, you know, the one lesson that Democrats have been willing to learn, or at least like kind of admit that they've learned, is, you know, that after, you know, the 70s, we're never going to, you know, back a left candidate or a progressive candidate ever again. And they've been basically riding that train to present day, right? They still talk about it. These like you have people, you know, like bringing on, shit, what the hell's that guy's name? Who's the Raging Cajun guy, the Clinton guy?
Oh, Carville.
Well,
I'm talking it's 2 a.m. in Moscow right now. Hello, Vlad. It's like, God damn it. You put this Skeletor on TV.
He's a caricature.
And let me tell you something, Max. If you have ever seen, and this is another example, Cavo is the Democrat and Mary is the Republican, and they play off each other in D.C.
They're so
if
gross.
You saw the monstrosity of the townhouse that they have right on the Potomac in Alexandria, it's like that stuff don't pay for itself. You got to grift real hard in order to keep a waterfront property like that.
That's a dual income grift.
That's for sure.
It is. I mean, this is what kind of blows me away, right? Is because it's from people like Carville who say it's like, look, you know, we ran McGovern in like 72. We got waxed. We can never make that mistake again. And yet I'm like, but you'll keep making a million other mistakes every single election and you'll never learn from them. Right. And that's what set us up for, you know, 2016 is like a lot of people kept saying, it's like, look, yes, there are a lot of like complex issues here that have built up this sort of animosity towards Hillary Clinton specifically and the Clinton dynasty itself as a representative of everything that's wrong with the Democratic Party. Again, in true Democratic fashion, they approach that with, well, it's just the voters who were wrong, right? They have the wrong mentality about this, and they need to shut up, realize that we're what's good for them. And if Trump wins, then essentially we're going to be able to always point to them and say, see, you idiots should have listened to us. Whereas, again, this is all just like, it's a shadow game being played over our heads, where it's like, for voters, it's not about who wins, you know, like in which party gets to kind of claim a moral victory. We're talking about our lives here. We're talking about our ability to live on a planet that hasn't been destroyed. We're talking about the ability to safeguard, you know, rights to abortion, gay marriage, the ability for people to make a living wage in this country, to actually not have their futures crushed by student debt, right? Like these are the stakes of what we're talking about. But for people like James Carville and for people at the kind of top of the Democratic Party apparatus, it's all just horse betting, right? I mean, like, and that's, I think, the thing that, you know, is driving us all nuts here. But like, if they really do show their hand when, you know, they trot out folks like Carville, who has been wrong about so many things for so long and so many times in my lifetime, but they bring him up like he's this kind of, he was right about basically one thing in like the early 90s. And now they bring him out like he was like this political guru. And I'm just like, you know, again, it's very selective what lessons the Democrats will actually learn from. Everything else, they will keep, you know, running their themselves straight into a wall. The point is that all of us are going to be the ones who suffer from that. And, you know, I think that, again, the question of a third political party is, it's always tough because, you know, I think, again, the lesson, I guess the McGovern type lesson that Republicans learned in the 90s was we cannot allow someone like Ross Perot to, you know, run an independent campaign, not because we think they're going to win, but because they're going to take enough votes away from us for the Democrats to win. So like that, the Ross Perot is basically the McGovern, Ross Perot is to the Republicans what McGovern is to the Democrats in a lot of ways. And so I do agree with you that was one of the guns that Trump was able to hold to the party's head when he threatened to do that. I think in Trump's mind, he may have been like, you know, I'm going to do this and win without you. For the Republicans, they're like, well, this is going to mean that the Democrats are going to win, right? Not that either of us is going to win. But, you know, there are certain sort of differences in the Democratic and Republican Party apparatus, as y'all know all too well. When you have people, when you have aces in the hole like Wasserman Schultz that you can kind of call in, when you have, you know, all that sort of backroom dealing that can essentially ensure that no matter what happens, the candidate that you want in there is going to be the one who gets through, regardless of what the voters are telling you. Then
you're super delegate. Yes, you're a super delegate. You're not just a delegate. You're a super delegate.
You have to. And again, I always felt that this was always Bernie's biggest flaw, is the fact that he is a political lifer in DC and he overthought the whole circumstance. It's like, no, you understand what's going on here, and you have to stop worrying about what the GOP might do. It's either a bullet to the head or death by a thousand paper cuts. You make the decision as to how you want this to happen, because either way, the Band-Aid's got to get ripped off. It just has to. We are a completely corporate captured government. We are. Mm-hmm. And to deny that that's where we are today is to delay the inevitable, because the working class will unite. It just needs the right leaders. It's not one person, but the right type of movement that can get it done.
And they need to stop fixating on divisive issues, which is what they're trying to do, and realize that if you're not in charge, you're one of us. So we're all on the same team, except for the people that are in charge.
And I really think the opportunity...
It's not a red-blue thing.
Yeah, this is like a... I really think if we start planning right now, like, there really is an opportunity in 24, because it's going to be Trump or DeSantis. It's pretty clear that that's what's coming.
You mean
coming.
You don't think it's going to be a Kamala Pete victory?
If that is...
Stop trying to make Kamala and Pete happen. It's not... People hate them.
But the establishment...
But that's all they have.
What they're going to do. So if the establishment is already saying that we are literally going to put up...
They're like, we got Mayo Pete. He's sitting in the corner. He's ready to go. We've been grooming him as a Manchurian for years. He's ready to go.
But this is like the last remnants of the corporatocracy in the sense that they really think that they're going to hoodwink people this time. It's not going to happen, especially because Pete never really had the opportunity to see what a sniveling little weasel he is. I mean, they learned in Iowa with what he did, but it didn't expand far enough. And if they're really going to try to put this guy at the front of the line, it's almost as if to say, wow, there's like a wide open opportunity here for a non-corporate person to step forward. Who could that be? I think that's really what it comes down to. And I think we have to consider the element that maybe it has to be a Trump-like situation where the leader of the progressive movement has to be somebody who's not already elected on Capitol Hill. It has to be somebody who comes from the outside. Do you think that that's how it's going to have to be? I mean, there's really not that many people that I could think of. Obviously, if he was more progressive, you know, you would have somebody like an Andrew Yang, but there's obviously also Marianne Williamson and Nina Turner in particular.
I think Marianne was on before. Marianne was on the thread before.
So I think that that's kind of, you know, we talked about this whole idea that they have to like sort of coalesce together. Yeah. And I do think that that is how it's going to have to happen.
It's not going to be Pete. That's not happening.
No, no matter what happens, even if he's somehow the nominee, that's a 35-40 state victory for the GOP.
I just had to say, when I look at Kamala and Pete, and to me, it's one person. It's Team Clinton, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. When I look at that, they're like trying to green eggs and ham us, right? Like if they follow us around enough, we'll finally taste it and be like, oh, okay. if they just morph that into the right identity and they just get the right message and they put her in the right place with the right heels, but it's not going to happen. This isn't a green eggs and ham thing where at the end we're all going to go, oh, yes, we do like Pete and Kamala. No, that's not going to happen.
No, it tastes like ish. It is ish.
The reality is they're going to lose. Like they're going to lose. So there is an opportunity for someone who isn't them to do what Trump did on that side. Like there is an opportunity because you can look at Kamala and Pete like Cruz and whoever and Rubio and say, oh, someone came along because they weren't really palatable. And that's what we need.
And that non-corporate person can easily appeal to those normie, privileged, Dem suburbanite base and tell them, you already know what Trump is like, and you know that his acolyte is the only other option. This is what's coming. And I guarantee you, if you nominate Pete or Kamala or both, they're getting back in the White House. So you better consider going in another path. And they have to have the balls to say that.
We need someone.
That's what's coming.
We need someone.
Help us, Superman.
Well, this is, it's funny just to think of Jen about the ways that they're trying to plant the seed of Kamala and Buttigieg. It reminds me of I grew up on Seinfeld, right? So it reminds me of the Seinfeld episode where George is like, my dating strategy, you know, when you first meet me, you hate me. I'm annoying. But like, I get in your head like a commercial jingle. It stands up. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to do that with Pete and Kamala. Yes. It's just not going to happen, or at least for not for enough amount of people. But so here's what I would say about this is going back to the Trump question. Why did the RNC capitulate to Trump? There's a number of reasons, but the RNC capitulated to Trump not because they were just scared of Trump. They were scared, like, to bring up another movie or Hollywood reference, one of the best lines, I think, in all of Hollywood is from the movie Tombstone, right? Where, you know, you had...
Who's your
Huckleberry? Do it.
It's an incredible movie. My brothers and I watched it all the time, but there's an amazing line where Kurt Russell, Wyatt Earp's character, is finally kind of fighting back against the cowboys who are kind of hurting the town and the outlaws and stuff like that. And he says, you know, you tell your people that I'm coming and hell's coming with me. That is what the RNC saw with Trump. Was it wasn't just him. They saw the people at his rallies. We remember, it's easy for us to forget because it's become normalized now. But when that rally was kind of happening in Chicago and you had people fighting in one of Trump's rallies and the rally got shut down, that terrified the hell out of the political establishment in Washington, D.C. And so that's kind of what put the fear of God into a lot of them. And that's become a normalized part of our political system right now. I mean, like, these people, whether, you know, they be kind of Trump acolytes, whether they be, you know, trolls who are just on the internet, they, you know, really act as a sort of, you know, political force to upend the comfort of, you know, the people in D.C. and that actually kind of scare them into thinking, all right, there's enough energy behind this or that candidate that if we spurn them, it's going to come back to bite us in the ass. And I mentioned that because that is what, you know, any Democratic challenger for the party needs to have and right now does not have. And so this is where it connects to the point that I was making earlier about needing to build our political muscles in other realms outside of just electoral campaigns. Because if you have a more organized working class coalition that actually has seen, because it's organized, people have organized in their own workplaces, they have forced their bosses to capitulate to their demands, or they have gone to city council meetings and forced their local governments to listen to them. America is a place where your average working person has been so thoroughly disempowered over their entire lifetimes that they've almost forgotten that they have the ability to, you know, change the world that they live in. We need to rebuild those atrophied muscles to remind ourselves that actually when we, like Bernie always said, when we come together, when we have that solidarity, when we are acting in concert across the things that normally divide us to advocate for our actual needs, we are an unstoppable force. And so we have a long way to go till people first remind themselves that they have it within their power to make the world over again. As you know, you guys just had Harvey Kay on, and you know, he's always talking about Thomas Paine, the famous words of Thomas Paine. We do have it within our power to make the world over again, but we need to, like, actually build the muscles up to do it. We need to do the hard work of organizing and coming together and working out our differences, realizing who our real enemies are and who they aren't, right? And then in that process, sort of building up the kind of power that could be behind, you know, a challenger candidate. But that's not the only place that energy goes, I guess, is the caveat that I keep making. But if that coalition built up that sort of muscle and you had a candidate who actually was bucking the party line, who actually was fighting for working people, and you got that coalition behind it, that may be enough to actually scare the Democratic establishment into capitulating a bit more. Right now, you do not have that. Right now, what you have is, again, a disempowered population that more or less sees the game of politics like the people on the ground in Tokyo watching Mothra and Godzilla go at it, right? I mean, like, that's basically where we are as a population when it comes to politics, is which monster do you want to root for and just hope that they don't crush the building that you and your family are living in? Like, we need more than that. We need politicians to listen to us. Right now, they do not feel like they have to. And if we are going to actually make that happen and lead the way to what you're describing, an actual insurgency candidacy or an insurgency movement with enough teeth that it could be a credible threat in a third party, you need to have the people behind you. And we have a long way to go to build that up, but we also don't have much time to do it. So we need all of us to get serious, to stop playing these goddamn games like we were started this conversation talking about, where we're at each other's throats over this or that, you know, bullshit. And you know, we really need to actually recognize the stakes of what we're up against and the stakes of not building that movement now, because the stakes are, frankly, the world that we live in and the future that currently is being foreclosed at a rapid pace.
Max Alvarez of the Real News Network. Where can people find you? How can they get more
involved? At the Real News Network.
Well, there could be some hashtags and some links.
But guys, seriously, if you're not subscribed to Real News Network, you really should. That, like, it's just a good staple to be subscribed
to.
And
is there a good website where everybody can find your work?
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate you having me on. Appreciate the conversation. That gave me more of a boost than the 3 cups of coffee that I've had this morning.
Jen, please tell Max what you're going to be doing today.
I don't know why he finds it so fascinating. So my girl, my person, my bestie and I are driving to Orlando to go get cookies. And the reason that we're going, there's a place there that makes half pound cookies. So each cookie is a half pound. It's a half pound cookie. And you have to order them in advance, which we did. We placed our orders. I feel like it's going to the soup Nazi. Like, then we scooch over here. So like we placed our orders and now we have to go up there and our orders will be ready
tomorrow. No cookie for you.
And so we're going to get the cookies. Really, it's an excuse. She calls it a Thelma and Louise trip. But really, if there were any reason for us to go somewhere, it would be a very good cookie.
Well, it's not coffee, but it's definitely gonna put some juice in you now, for sure.
They're big cookies.
So we are, and just so you know, we are planning a live stream Festivus
on the 23rd. Wednesday,
the 22nd. It's gonna be the 22nd. It's
on the
23rd, but the day we will record is on the 22nd.
You will see our new Festivus poll. Will be here behind us, and
if you want to air some grievances,
we're starting with the airing of the grievances.
You got a lot of problems with you people. We're going to hear about it.
So if you want to drop in with some of our guests, we're going to have sort of like rotating
people
on the show.
It's going to be a Festivus cocktail party. Yeah,
so you can drop in and air your grievances to whoever's pissing you off. You
know. Now, whoever wants to come here live can deal with Peter because he's going to be doing feats of strength.
And oh, God, please stop this. Come on, George, fight your father.
Oh my God. So whoever wants to come down to the new studio and locally and challenge Peter for Festivus feats of strength, let us know.
I don't know. It's like it's putting me on a swivel or something. You're going to be like, okay.
Literally the best invitation I could receive. It hits all the points. I get to yell about stuff. It's Seinfeld themed. So yeah, count me in.
Oh, definitely. We will definitely send you the link to come on for Festivus.
Why are you people causing so much trouble?
I hate when you do, Jerry.
I know. Definitely not one of my questions.
So I guess that sounds awesome. I want some of that cookie. Yeah, definitely count me in for the airing of grievances portion of the Festivus live stream.
And what is your website where everybody can find everything you're doing?
So yeah, just again, thank you both for having me on. Thank you for the work that you do. Thank you to everyone watching. And yeah, please subscribe and support generational change and support independent media across the board. Like we said at the beginning of this, we are all up against a massive corporate media system that serves the ruling class, and we all need to be working together to build up a more robust independent media ecosystem that can survive the Silicon Valley, you know, like shadow banning and all that crap. So it's important. I just wanted to bring us back there. It's important to support independent media in general, and I appreciate y'all having me on. If folks want to find me and my stuff, you know, I'm on Twitter at Maximilian_ALV, I think. But, you know, I host the podcast Working People, where you can hear me interview workers from different sectors all across the board. We just published an important interview with three Columbia grad student workers who are currently on strike. They've been on strike since November 3rd. You can also listen to interviews where I've talked to Kellogg's workers who have been on strike for months. I talked to workers all over the place, and it's important to lift up those voices, which is something we do on Working People, something we do at The Real News. If you want to find those, Working People's on all the podcast platforms, but you can also find it at The Real News Network. That's therealnews.com. If you want to support us, go to therealnews.com/support. But we have incredible shows for everyone. I do a lot of labor coverage, but other folks do it as well. We have a show called The Police Accountability Report, where Steve and Janice and Taya Graham investigate what corporate media won't and what local media won't, right? They watch the cops, and they actually have produced results where people have gotten convictions overturned, where police, you know, have kind of had to back off bullying different people into, you know, forced confessions and stuff like that. We have a show called Rattling the Bars about the prison industrial complex, hosted by legendary former Black Panther and longtime political prisoner of 44 years, Eddie Conway. It's an amazing that I get to work with Eddie every day. But, you know, basically the point is we do a lot of great stuff at The Real News. Yeah. And I really hope people check it out. Please support us so that we can keep doing great stuff like that. Go to The Real News. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're all over the place. And again, please support independent media across the board.
Thank you so much, Max.
Max Alvarez, The Real News Network. Have a great day. We'll see you for Festivus, my friend.
See you guys then. Thanks so much.
Bye. Take care, brother.
Bye.
It's always good.
That's definitely one of the best.
Well, people. It's always good really to find a fellow Seinfeld fanatic. Now, listen, we've got to expedite this because my girl's going to be here in a bit and we're hitting the road soon.
We need critical thinking, and that is absolutely true. In fact, no third party was more impressive than the Bull Moose party.
Here he is, obsessed with Teddy.
Well, Teddy's my man, so what are you going to do? But before we go, we obviously have to do Focus on Florida. And
did you like my graphic?
Yeah, really good. So Mr. Dictator himself is doing his thing. He's doing his best. Let's just put it this way. Our governor is definitely doing his best Trump impression. There's no question about it. May not talk like him much, but certainly this idea that Governor DeSantis feels that he needs a Florida paramilitary force outside of federal control. I mean, what does that tell you?
Are
you
it's beyond to frightening to me. And it's really surreal. It's surreal to me that this is actually happening. First of all, I think that it's, I did watch Bo on this. And if you don't watch Bo, The Fifth Column, you really should. He talked about this. So it's an absurd concept that there's no possibility of it happening. Certainly not with the budget that he's allocated for it. And Bo, break it down for you, because he understands this stuff way better than me. So I don't have any real fear about it happening. Let me be very clear. It's silliness. It's really just a virtue signal to the base, to the crazy rabid people that would like to see that.
And also one of the,
it's not, it can't happen.
And I also think one of the advantages that DeSantis has over Trump is the fact that he really is in the spotlight right now. Trump is not, and he hasn't, and he will not have been in the White House for about 3 years before things really start ratcheting up. Whereas, you know, DeSantis is really trying to make his mark right now. And I know everybody is thinking, oh, well, he's just trying to run for re-election. He pretty much already has that wrapped up.
Yeah, that's not going to be a problem for him.
The fact that he's already going to Iowa should tell you all you need to know. Because he ain't going to Iowa for any other reason other than to plant the seeds with the Iowa Republican Party that he is planning to run for president. That is what that is all, without question, is why he's doing what he's doing. And so we highlight these things every time we focus on Florida, because we know where the path is leading for Ron DeSantis. It is leading straight to the White House. And anybody else who can't see that is not paying attention. And so on another note, we obviously want to focus in on, there is a bill that Florida will allow businesses to sue local governments if ordinances lead to loss of revenue. This is another dystopian example of corporate special interests overriding the will of the people.
Here's the status. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted 7-4 to back the proposal, which is Senate Bill 620, would allow businesses to sue if local ordinances cause at least 15% losses of revenue or profits. The bill would apply to businesses that have been operating for at least 3 years. So there's going to be a back and forth on this. I don't know ultimately how far it'll go, but it's, you know, it's really scary to think about that sort of effect on local rule, which is really counterintuitive to what we normally see in Florida, which is, you know, generally red places are more about local rule. This is an interesting thing where they're going more authoritarian than they have in the past regarding, you know, county control.
Yeah. And this is supposed to be a county dominant state, but at the same time, you know, small businesses are supposed to have the ability to make a living, but also not have the ability to sue simply because you don't like the way things are going. And again, if we're talking real free market capitalism, it's sink or swim, not as it has been involved in the United States. It's socialism for the wealthy.
Right. They get social benefits.
And rugged individualism for everybody else.
So now here's the perspective. So Senator Doug Broxson, Republican in Gulf Breeze, says he loves the spirit of the bill because we're a big state. We have hundreds of jurisdictions that make decisions and sometimes they get it wrong. So that's basically the way of saying that in a majority red state, there are these blue districts that occasionally impose restrictions on us that we don't like. That's basically what that says. And I don't know how I feel about this one or the other. I have not read this legislation. I just think that it's interesting that they're going like really anti-home rule, which is generally not the conservative approach.
The great and wonderful Marianne Williamson checks in to let you know that doesn't think it'll happen here. It is a model similar to Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Oh, no. Marianne, I didn't mean that couldn't happen here. What I meant is that based on the budget that DeSantis has allocated for this, it can't happen this incarnation of what he's proposing based on what he doesn't have the resources to actually impose this. That's what I meant. And Bo's video on explaining that logistically is what I was talking
about. If any of you guys have not seen Bo of the Fifth Column, we highly recommend. If anybody can speak to rural conservative America, this is the guy.
Right.
He is the perfect blend of progressive and libertarian. It is a real treat. We're hoping to have him on the show again really soon. Really knows a thing or two. And so, of course, speaking of not in the panhandle, but near the panhandle, in Gainesville, University of Florida wants to ban critical race from study titles.
Okay, now this is not what it appears. And I want to be clear on this to people. This is not what it appears. And actually, this is the kind of nonsense that now people are having to deal with. Okay, so what this is about a title of a course at the collegiate level, which had critical race in its title. As I said a long time ago when this came up, critical race theory is a thing. It's just not what they're talking about that it is. Critical race theory is an actual discussion at that's what I said. I said it's probably like a college course, whatever. So now they're having to jump through hoops, changing the name of a course so as to not get repercussions and potentially lose. I don't know if they were talking about like donor funding, endowment funding, people using leverage over the university. So they're actually now having to change the name. And people are complaining about them doing that.
It's become such a trigger word.
Right. So I just want to be clear. This isn't that the University of Florida is banning critical race theory. That's not happening. And there should be lots of critical race theory, but it's funny that that's what they're using to call what we call history.
Well, if you want another example of why critical race theory needs to be talked about, even if it makes you uncomfortable, proposed Florida State House maps could disenfranchise Black Tampa Bay voters.
Yeah.
What a shock.
Yeah. So apparently what's happening in the Tampa area with the proposed redistricting is they're merging together. They're taking three Black representatives and merging their districts.
Oh my God.
So that two of them will no longer have a seat. That's what it's looking like. So, we're not so impressed, Florida legislature.
No, and again, this is so ridiculous. And one of the last things that I do want to conclude with, I will not name the person, but it is a person working for one of the senatorial campaigns. And
You're talking about Florida.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And this person who, on good authority, assured me that one of the people most directly responsible for the maps that are drawn in the state of Florida is none other than Debbie Wasserman.
Well, we knew that from her time in the legislature. She works hand in hand with the Republicans there to keep her fiefdom exactly as
it is. And the person swore me to secrecy. Is like, you cannot say that.
We've known this. This is not news to us. She's very influential in that. And I think one of the reasons that the Republican legislature is fine letting her maintain her fiefdom is she essentially is a Republican. She's a pro-choice Republican. So yeah, I mean, any way you turn it, it works for them to have her where she is.
All I can tell you is that, and again, I will not say who the person is, but let's just say that a person who's high up in the labor movement, I had a conversation with, and he took a shine to me.
Who wouldn't really?
Thank you, Jen. But the person, when I brought up Debbie, basically alluded to the fact that, well, Debbie's a friend. And it's like, Debbie may be a friend of you, but Debbie is not a friend of labor.
No. If you're
a leader in the labor movement and you can't differentiate between personal and professional, that's a problem.
But that's how it all works. And that is the problem.
One of the reasons why I also believe that Charlie Crist is going to be the nominee is because he has these longstanding relationships.
Because he's old.
And it's not just that he's old.
And he's already been there.
Let me tell you something. I sat down with him for a few minutes to talk when I was there. It was just him and I. And I can see why people gravitate to him. He's a very disarming type personality. They joke he's a Ken doll and all that. But he remembers names that, you know, he remembered my name. And the fact that he really has that ability to let you know that I really care. That is something where you can see why Chris King showed up to endorse Charlie. Sean Shaw showed up to endorse Charlie.
I don't know that people watching this know who those people are, because I live in Florida and I only know them because you tell me who they are.
Fair enough. But again, this is one of the trepidatious parts of politics, which is there's a lot of people who can't see.
Trepidatious?
Trepidatious? Trepidatious, I said it wrong. But one of the trepidatious part, well, I said it wrong, but I know, but the word is not incorrect. Saying it wrong, yes, but not in the context of what I'm talking about. No matter how bad things are, there are people who will overlook the fact that that representative is not doing justice to the people who need it the most because they have a personal connection to that person. And so that's the evolution that we're really trying to get past. I can get along with somebody who is a representative, but if that representative is not serving the needs of the people, then you do not support them politically. This, and again, if the person then takes that personally, then they're not really a friend. My closest friend that I grew up with is one of the most devout Trump-supporting conservatives you could possibly imagine. He and I can always have conversations politically, and he will literally rag the ish out of me about why, you know, I'm a communist and all, and it's all
commie.
And it's all in jest, because at the end of the day, we will find common ground, but I'll never vote the way he votes, and he ain't gonna vote the way I vote. Okay. That's the way it should be. You can have friendships and not support what that person is saying.
You can have friendships and go drive 3 hours to get cookies.
That's true, which you have to do.
Which I have to do. So what's coming up this week?
On Wednesday? I'm not sure. What is on the calendar for Wednesday?
Interestingly, India Walton, because she came up tonight, and I was about to say, India is going to be on the show Wednesday, guys. So we're going to have her on. We're obviously...
How do you like them apples?
Yeah.
You got Marianne Williamson in the chat. You got Max Alvarez from Real News.
And we will also...
And now we're getting Marianne Williamson back on the show.
We'll get Marianne back on the show.
And I will say this. You want to talk about the airing of grievances when India Walton comes on the show? Oh,
there'll be airing of grievances.
It's going to be her first real interview since the election.
And we will also be speaking with Michael Albert. Mm-hmm. And he's an author. I have the book. It's labor, it's unions. I cannot remember. No Bosses.
We will be.
It's called No Bosses.
So we will be literally uplifting labor on Wednesday. So you're not going to want to miss it.
And then what else is coming up? I don't even know.
I don't even know if next. I think we may have next Sunday.
I don't. It's not on here. But if you do, and we're going to start doing candidate panels. I want to do them statewide. The idea of doing like a group of New Yorkers, a group of I just think it's smart to do it that way.
And apparently,
as someone who did panels,
a friend of mine who is on Mr. Crist's campaign wants to get him on the podcast. So that would be interesting.
We could be talking with Charlie Crist.
We'll be talking with the runner-up for
I'm sorry, Charlie.
But the truth is he's a sitting congressman. So, I mean, that's the only thing, because we do not promote non-corporate candidate.
He's a little too friendly with Debbie, but
he's a little too friendly with big money.
We'll forgive him for that. He's not taking big sugar money, which is obviously good. It's not enough.
To me, to specify you're not taking one particular type of corporate money.
As you like
money,
to say, it's sufficient. All interconnected it's in all one big system.
So if we have an opportunity to have him on, of course we will. He is a congressperson and he's the former governor of our state. So sure. Yes, but we are not promoting him as a candidate as long as he takes corporate donations.
No, listen, give him credit.
We'll platform him because he is a congressperson, but we are not promoting.
No, but we want to give people the opportunity to hear what he has to say, because he could very well be the nominee for the state of Florida, and that does matter. So with that said, we really appreciate you guys. We both have to get on the road, and we will see you all on Wednesday. Hope you enjoyed it. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.